was published in Physics of A, and the motivation for it, which indeed comes from black holes, is in Nuclear Physics B. And this is a joint work with et al. Levine. Okay, let's try this. Oh, it works. So before calculating entanglement and bothering you with all kinds of details about formation, distillation, etc., I have to introduce the states, the spaces, the subspaces, variables in general. And that means I must say a couple of words about loop quantum gravity. It is a quantization of general relativity in 3+1 dimensions, quite conservative in its approach. One of the interesting features is that the variables, unlike the standard metric approach, are based on tetrads, which are basically just frames, orthogonal Lorentz frame at each point. And using them, I can recover the metric. And the connections that tell us how vectors are parallel transported from one point to another of the four-dimensional manifold. In addition to just fanciful rewriting of Hilbert-Einstein metric, another term is added to the action, which is zero, identically zero on classical solutions, but contributes to a non-trivial quantization. Then we want to get Hamiltonian dynamics some stage, so we need time slicing, partial gauge fixing, get three-dimensional space and time, and then we have three-dimensional connections and extrinsic curvature that tells us how our slabs of space are fit into the space-time. And finally, the canonical variables are certain linear combinations of the connections and three-dimensional frames. And those are indeed conjugate canonical variables, satisfy usual Poisson bracket relations. And we are faced with, well, a whole bunch of problems that should be overcome. Standard constraints, which are present in usual approaches to gravity, classical or quantum. And in addition, since our variables are reference frames, rotation of reference frames doesn't influence the metric that we recover for them. We have also gauge freedom, gauge Gauss constraint. And for reasons that I'm not going to enter here, our gauge degrees of freedom are just SU2s. Now we want to quantize. We have tons of constraints, and so we have, or we want to try to get rid of as many as possible. So to get rid of the gauge freedom, of rotational freedom, which is reduced to SU2, instead of in our connections, we use holonomies. So we pick up a path, make a path integral, okay, exponentiate. So instead of SU2 algebra valued object, we get a group element. And that's almost that. We have our configuration space, which is described by all possible holonomies, and the phase space, our conjugate variables, which are fluxes, integrals of the tetrads over the area. So we are ready to build the Hilbert space. We have our configuration space, and then we need functions, more exactly, functionals of those variables. And this is done with the help of cylindrical functions, which, well, maybe a bit of, fancy word, but roughly, it's just functions on the graphs, on all possible graphs that we can embed into three-dimensional manifold. If we deal with a single edge, we have complex valued function of a SU2, single group element. Now we have more edges, so we have more complicated arguments for our functions. Then we want a discrete basis. We want something nice. So we use Peter Weyl's theorem to decompose the space of the functions on the group element into a direct sum of different representations of SU2. Now, this is just for one edge. We have more, so labeling becomes more complicated. And finally, to recover the entire Hilbert space, we have to sum over all possible graphs. Now, we are not done with the constraints. We are not done even with the SU2 gauge invariance yet, because while gauge doesn't matter for the path, we still have a gauge freedom at the vertices, at the vertices of each edge. So So we need gauge invariant states. We contract with invariant SU2 invariant tensors. We get those tensors as intertwiners or invariant tensors of the representations that meet at each vertex. So for example, here we have like three edges meeting in a single vertex. So by assigning them fixed representations, we get just one invariant tensor. If we have four or more edges meeting a single vertex, we have, of course, much more complicated and interesting structure. For example, four representations of S2 fundamental representations that carry spin 1/2 give us a two-dimensional space. So for a single fixed graph, and I'm not going to bother you with the details how to deal with other constraints, for a single fixed graph, on the one hand, we have functions on all edges, modular gauge symmetries at the vertices. The discrete basis is given by the intertwiners, by the invariant tensors at the vertices. And we can think about them, for example, like in the case of harmonic oscillator. We have our energy levels, which we just label N, 0, 1, 2, 3, so on, 4. And we get the wave functions. Here, we get the wave functions by contracting indices of the invariant tensors with the indices of the representation. And, well, we have geometric operators, which probably one of the more important results in quantum gravity so far, which have discrete spectrum. The functions, the basis states that I described here, are called spin networks for an obvious reason. And having a surface that cuts, for example, such a network, we recover its area as a sum of elementary areas. Each of those elementary areas is related to the representation that the edge that it intersects carries on. Well, that's probably about what I had to tell you about it. And now the black holes. As you probably know, black holes are very old. I think it's a very old idea. They predate both quantum gravity and general relativity. This mentioned in 1783 as an object that all light emitted from such a body would be made to return towards it by its own proper gravity. However, in general case, we still don't know how to do the dynamics. So my model is extremely simplistic. No dynamics. Our object is just a static black hole. And actually, we're not going to use much features of the black hole. So apparently, it should work also for any closed surface. So our states are all possible spin networks that cross the horizon and are consistent with the given area. I mentioned the area operator just in the previous slide. Then the black hole feature, the only one that we are using, is that we have no clue what's inside. And if we have no clue what's inside, we just coarse grain. We coarse grain all the spin networks that we have just a single vertex. And as a result, SU2 invariance at each vertex is translated just to one global SU2 invariance for the horizon states. So what we are counting when we, for example, trying to get black hole entropy are the invariant tensors of all those different representations meeting in a single vertex. We're counting intertwiners, we're adding spins, playing with states of total spin zero. And this is how our story proceeds. To make life simpler, I work with a fixed scale, spin 1/2, label all the edges that cross the surface by spin 1/2 or spin 1 or so on. It's possible to work with the more complicated situations. I do not make any particular assumptions about the area spectrum. It's still controversial. It's enough that this is just a certain function of label J that we put on each vertex that crosses the surface. It's really interesting to see what happens if you work at different scales. But for my presentation, I would like to stick almost all the time to a qubit black hole, quite a standard construction in many more or less hand-waving descriptions of black holes. So for starters, we deal with qubit black holes. So the label, we assume that all edges that cross our horizon carry the fundamental representation of SU2, spin 1/2. Well, then the story how to calculate entanglement, how to calculate entropy is almost embarrassingly simple. It's even a shame to publish a paper just about this result. We assume fixed area, so we fix the number of those spins, let's say 2n. We have to get an even number if we want total spin 0. Then we have all possible different states of 2n qubits. Yep. Here we are back to the realm of quantum information. 2n qubits that sum up to total spin 0. Unfortunately, glitches in the software. This is instead of the column, it should be asymptotically equal. So we can easily do combinatorics, especially with spin 1/2. We get the result. Given 2n qubits, we get the number of different orthogonal spin 0 states. It's given by a Catalan number. Has a nice asymptotic expression. With entropy is just the logarithm of all different distinguishable states. And it comes as no surprise that we get a term which is proportional to the area, the standard Bekenstein-Hawking term in the black hole entropy, and the famous, or infamous, depending on your point of view, logarithmic correction with a prefactor 3/2. So far, so good. And now we do the same thing, just in a fancy way. So I introduce a density matrix, which is an equal mixture of all those capital N states. Surprise, surprise, it's von Neumann entropy is log capital N, the same number. So what I did in the last third of this slide, I took a simple counting story and made it complicated. Why? Because now when I have states, in a more precise form, I can think about the subsystems. I can group 2n qubits that form it into two groups and look at their correlations, look at their entanglement. And this is what I want to do. To do this properly, we need a lot of combinatorics. It's especially simple when we work with fundamental representations, like spin 1/2 representation of SU2. So having 2n two-dimensional representations, we can decompose it as a direct sum of those terms, product terms. In each term, we have a single copy of representation space and a degeneracy space, which for in this case is particularly simple, is a certain representation of a permutation group of 2n object. More precisely, it's given by this Young tableau. We are going to see it in a moment in a simple example. So for example, working with 4 spins 1/2, trivial exercise, probably end of the undergrad, we get 2 0 subspaces, 3 spin 1 subspaces, 1 spin 2 subspace. Now, when we want to count the degeneracies, when we want to count and find the dimension of the degeneracy space, nothing works better than just counting on Young tables. In this case, they consist of 2 rows. And since we are interested in the spin 0 subspace, the 2 rows have an equal number of elements. So counting the standard table of 4 elements, the arrangement is standard, meaning increasing to the right, increasing to the bottom. We have just 2 options. Indeed, degeneracy of 0 subspaces 2. Of course, we are interested in the case where n is large. Now, to calculate the entanglement, we need to find a nice basis, a nice decomposition, to guess an answer and then try to prove it. So the quantity that I start with is the entanglement of formation that this audience I don't have to introduce in very many words, just an average and minimal over average degree of entanglement of the decomposition of a given state. So what I do, I play the same representation theory game, grouping into 2k and 2n minus 2k blocks, picking up representation subspace, which is just a space of generalized singlets, and the degeneracy subspaces. That suggests a notation. Singlet label, degeneracy labels. And when I take partial trace and I get obverse log 2j plus 1, and number of times I have to deal with each term is given by the degeneracies of the appropriate subspaces. So indeed, for this particular decomposition, I calculated the average entanglement. The point is that for this family of states, and also for more complicated states, we have more, something else than spin 1/2s or unequal mixtures. This is indeed entanglement of formation, and it's also equal to all other measures of entanglement. So I spare you a brute force proof. Those who like convexity, concavity arguments may enjoy it. Much simpler is a proof by distillation. We can identify J singlets by locally, non-destructively. So probability of hitting on a particular one is given by the same factor. Entanglement which contained in them is log 2 J plus 1. So we are back to the same number. And since we know nice bounds on the entanglement, we can prove that indeed all reasonable measures of entanglement are equal. We can now play with numbers. We can calculate entanglement of block of 2 qubits versus the rest. For example, in the case n goes to infinity. Those are two types of the states which are involved in the process, either tensor products of zero or generalized spin 1 singlets. Again, unentangled fraction of states is 1/4. We get some number for the entanglement. Not so interesting. Asymptotic case of equal partition is much more interesting. Entanglement in this case is 1/2 log n. And then we can calculate entanglement of the whole, entropy of the whole versus compare it to the entropy of the parts. We calculate the entropies of the reduced density matrices and calculate quantum mutual information, which is a total amount of classical and quantum correlation that is contained in the state. And this is okay, it's 3 times the entanglement, and the result persists for most unequal partitions as well. But what's much more interesting, this is the logarithmic correction. So at least at this level of modeling, corrections to the black hole entropy represent correlations in the state that describes the horizon. The result that I described so far is universal in a sense that I don't have to work with spin 1/2 labeling to get it. Any fixed labeling will do. And again, I prefer to skip the calculations and just come to the open questions. We have 2 sets of questions, black hole ones about evolution of entanglement, about potential relation between the entanglement and evaporation, and of course, semi-classical sets of questions. On quantum informational side, we produced a family of states which is not locally orthogonal in the strict definition which was given by Horodetsky because of the degeneracies. Still, keeping in the spirit with the conjecture, it's a state which can be locally distinguished in an undestructive way. So it's not a big surprise that all measures of entanglement are equal. Interesting question is, of course, if there is something else beyond local distinguishability that can give us equal entanglement measures. Thank you.